The only reason you're not dead now, the only reason I don't kill you, is that it would upset my cellmates. Now, they have things to do, and I don't want to be slowed down by your miserable death. But believe me, one more sound out of you, and that's it.
The sinking sand of despair, the smell of dread in the air. I'm head to toe in my own fear. I'm going to die, no need to cry.
Episode 124 of The Michael Anthony Show, David McMillan. Thanks for coming on.
A pleasure to be here, Michael.
How many years have you spent in jail?
I haven't actually added it up. It got kind of depressing when I got to 23 years. Perhaps defensively I say this, but most of that time, well, over half of it, was being held for a pending or threatened charge or an accusation that either crumbled or, as in the case of Thailand, I walked away from. So more years than was sensible.
So what's the story? You had a middle-class upbringing.
Yeah.
Your old man. Your old man's an MBE or something, doesn't he?
Better OBE.
OBE. I wouldn't be too aware of the differences between those two.
I can barely follow them. And they're chased by people who like to collect trivia.
Yeah, exactly. He was one of the main lead guys in the original ITV, was he?
It was. I think it was called Rediffusion and back in those days.
You would have hung around with...
I've been thrown out of some good schools. My dad, hardly knew him, really. He had a habit of getting himself a little family and then either upgrading or moving on.
So he had multiple families?
Well, he was quite clever, really. I didn't see the pattern until I was old enough to realize what the strategy was. But he would woo colonials of various kinds. His first wife was what was once called Rhodesia. That was a little ludicrous white enclave in Africa. It's now Zimbabwe. And had a president for life, didn't they, with Mugabe?
Yeah.
But so when he had a couple of children with that wife, then when that came to an end, he sent them all the way back to, funded them back to Rhodesia. And then he met my mother, and she was in London at the time. But because she had this Australian background, there was an exit strategy already in mind. So off and on, after that marriage broke up, I went to Australia for a few years, then to Los Angeles, and then back again. So it was a mixture of schooling.
But there was a lot of money there, was there, growing up, your parents?
By the time I came along, yes, there was. I've got some 8mm Kodachrome footage from 1958. That has me as baby David, dressed in the height of fashion for two-year-olds at the time, staggering around Hyde Park, where John, my father, is trying to get me to walk, and using one of these ancient... I couldn't work out what it was at first because it was so big, a £5 note, an old blue note, as they used to call them, waving it in front of me. Then little David's grasping for it in his trench coat. And I think I've been grasping for that for many years since.
Was it the kind of lack of stability behind the family unit that made you take such a strange route to chasing money? What was the behavioural problems about? You got kicked out of schools. What was wrong with you?
It wasn't behavioural problems. It was the behaviour of the chemistry teacher who got cold feet on the LSD experiments.
And what do you mean?
Well, I befriended this guy who was a chemistry teacher.
Proper Breaking Bad job.
And
what age were you?
16 or something like that. He got very nervous about where this was headed. Decided I don't think he was technically up to the job, Michael. You know.
What do you mean by LSD experiment?
Oh, to manufacture some.
And for the class to take it.
Well, that would have been fun. I really didn't know much about it. I think the first I had was some that had been made, it might have been from here, the little grey dots they were, about the size of a sweetener. But the thing about LSD is it only works once. Well, that's my experience. You get something out of the first dose of a bat. There's a great chemist called Shuglin who dedicated his life to making interesting psychotropics. Never found anything really interesting about it since.
What was the first time like?
Good. I mean, I got the full-on Technicolor visions. Like, I suppose if I was in some place like the studio, I'm guessing the walls would turn into the inside of a body, you know, it would be like...
A weird thing to do, though, to develop a relationship with a chemistry teacher to try and get him to manufacture LSD. Where did you get
the whole
persuasive
idea.
Skills, though?
When I was 12, I had a job on local television in Melbourne, which was the junior news. And it was all right. It was a 5-minute kids thing, you know, elephant at the zoo has babies, that sort of stuff. I did that for a year and I earned some money on it. And I paid for my own private school after that. But private school was a great disappointment. It was all a boys' school and I didn't think much of that. While I was reading the news at 12, I fell in love with my co-presenter. She was 17. It wasn't going to work.
And you were 12.
Mm. And then a year later, ran away with a MG sports car. Yeah. My mother was out of town in New York at the time, and I took off. My grandmother was most upset. Thought she'd let the side down.
You were 13, though?
Yeah.
And were you having sex with her?
Yes. Yeah. It turned out she was a lesbian. But that really is neither here nor there. It only added color to things.
Color is the word, though. It's like you're addicted to color and adventure.
Oh, definitely.
Did you figure out that was the only way you could really exist?
I wanted to experience everything conceivable. Whatever it was, I wanted to do it. I've got a genetic flaw without any particular fear of things.
Yeah, what's that about?
I don't know. I've looked it up. Apparently, some people are born with a faulty risk assessment.
How many people have you seen killed in front of you? Probably numerous times you've seen people's lives end in front of you.
A dozen or something like that.
And but you don't, do you give a shit? No, not really. Not like you should.
Well, look, most people give a shit because they think they might be next. But I learned from jail experience that I remember talking to some guy. We were chatting about what to do with our television sets or something and where we could get some food organized. We came out of the building. There was a dead body in front of us with a couple of knives sticking out of it. And we literally, because we had to settle this thing about the TVs, we didn't actually break the conversation as we stepped over the corpse, other than to look down and around and make sure we were not going to get the blame for it. So that kind of stayed with me, that sense of...
Does that personality trait that has a kind of addiction to fearlessness, adventure, and doesn't really recognize risk, does it have morals?
You have to...
Have you ever felt bad for something?
Learn them and apply them. It's not as though they start screaming at you.
Yeah.
Because most ethical behavior, you could say, is on the basis of fear of retribution. But I think it's a little bit innate with humans. I mean, with all primates.
It's really a jungle approach to life you have. Have you ever lost sleep over guilt?
When my wife died due to my carelessness, when I was, okay, I should back up a little bit here and say the reason I was chasing money was not for its own sake. I just wanted it defensively so that adults wouldn't tell me what to do.
And materialism was something that probably is subliminally valued because you came from money. Not having money or becoming a complete kind of dirtbag criminal without the dough to back it up would have been... you still had a valuation of status. Your dad had the 5 Rovi in Hyde Park and you were 2. You were still moulded in the money matters model.
Look, one of the earliest influences with my Rich and Tony friends of my mother, even though after the divorce she didn't have anything really, but our friends were quite classy.
Yeah, and having anything doesn't even really mean it. It doesn't have to be physical, even having anything. Once you kind of had something and then you go broke over something like a divorce, people pretend like they still have it. And once you're kind of considered in that class bracket, it doesn't really leave. And you kind of float around, you have the drinks and you talk in a certain accent that makes it seem like you're elite.
Oh, yes, the charade can go on like that. Perhaps not so much anymore, but there was a time I could sail through customs, and by adopting a certain tone, I could probably get the police on duty to help carry my cargo through.
How many times have you been married?
Twice, we'll say. Some of the ceremonies were kind of made up.
How many women have you loved?
Three. Clelia, I met her in Australia. She was the daughter. You've got a point about money. Her dad was wealthy, had a few restaurants.
And did he hate you?
No, he quite liked me.
How did he never assess what you did for a living?
I think he tolerated me and half admired me because I was independent. I didn't want their family's money. I wasn't interested. And I loved Clelia.
Did you know you were?
Oh, yeah.
Nuts. Yeah.
She tried to put up some nonsense about, you know, perfectly well. He sort of gave me the advice of, you know, get out while you can, you know, when the pickings are good. But what, at 20, I'm going to listen to that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
You know what was a great inspirational film? It was The French Connection. When the Frenchman there gets away with it in the end, I thought, yeah, smuggling narcotics. Why didn't I think of that before? You know, the hours are good. Short work day, I guess. And I could not have to do anything other than things that I wanted to do.
What was your first ever shift in smuggling gear?
6 kilos of hash from India. I learned everything the hard way, Michael. I made every conceivable mistake possible.
But how did it get to the point in which you were carrying hash to India?
I left Australia wanting to go and get some. I
looked career choice.
Yeah. One of the first contacts I lynched out of a newspaper article. You know, I was looking for somebody who I thought would be in the business, had some money, but couldn't import because I figured I could. There was a story about a guy that had been in the circus, was accused of getting his income from massage parlors, to put it politely, and had been charged with some trivial thing, and I think there was a small amount of drugs in it. Anyway, everything about him, he seemed, from the story, great. And because they gave the street address in the newspaper story, I went down there looking for him. I couldn't find it, of course, but the posties know everything. Oh, you want the drug dealer, mate? Oh, he's in number 23. Knocked on the door. When it sounded noisy in the evening, Joe sent me, was welcomed in, sat down around with a bunch of people on a huge hookah pipe, smoking hash, and I didn't overdo it because I had my own axe to grind. And next thing, he's financing me to a run over there. Now, I get to India. I don't know anybody. I've got a loose connection with a guy that was on the run and had infiltrated into the Hare Krishnas and was hiding out in New Delhi, but I never really found him, and probably just as well. Don't trust criminals. They're your worst contacts. My best careers have all been civilians.
Were you loyal, or were you bogey?
I always wanted...
Did you fuck people over?
No, never. The reason is, I learned early that you never know when you'll need friends. And also, I'll call it vanity, but I didn't want to be seen as some kind of a lowlife. And if they got into trouble... I mean, Clelia, my first wife, was... saying, stop doing it yourself. I mean,
how do you break down a run? You collect the gear.
Well, you've got the important thing is the route and how you're going to disguise the origins of where you've come from. Because I realized from the very first one, when I arrived with 6 kilos of hash, stuffed into a 1950s Grundig radio, an old tube job, gutted completely, didn't work. A very kindly customs officer, family man, I guess, stopped me at Sydney, opened up my suitcase, in which there's a couple of socks and a towel and this huge thing. And it's buckled. It's bent at the top because there's so much in there. I don't know what it smelled like. Hash, probably. Anyway, he spun the dial on it and the that it didn't move at all. He didn't want to go any further. He looked around to make sure nobody would think him out for letting somebody go. And I was so young, 18. He looked at my British passport and he said, are you going back there? No, no, no. See that you don't. And you can take your radio with you. Have a good time.
So why did he let you do it?
Because he was kind-hearted enough and wise enough to know that somebody who clearly had no criminal past, when thrown into the giant maw of prisons and institutions and all of that, would only come out 10 times worse, knowing all the wrong people.
You start shifting hash to India, and then it develops cocaine, heroin, and you become one of the most sought-after smugglers in the game.
Recruited some helpers in there with the couriers and learned a bit about that. I found myself...
How much money were you making?
At its peak, and the profits were very high back then.
Like in a year?
5 million or something like that.
5 million quid?
Yeah.
And what were you doing with the money?
Well, picture a rented townhouse with little furniture in it because I just haven't had time, Michael. Busy, busy, busy. Got to get that stuff down your nose. Won't do it by itself. And a glass-topped coffee table with...
Prostitutes?
Piled with crash... No, no, no. I knew too much about them to let any of those into my life.
So what would you do with that much money? Just rent a gaff? Because you couldn't buy a gaff because people were going, where the fuck are you getting this dough?
It was a little easier on that score in those days. I did buy a couple of places by smurfing the money into... bank accounts from across the road.
What a ridiculous thing it was to continue once you had the money. You could have just fucked off.
Yeah. I was on my way with $500,000 to buy properties in Earl's Court Road and got kind of waylaid, stopped in Thailand, and my Thai business partner. And I found him at the back of the Metro Hotel, a rundown, slimy place, because I'd been using some street guy before then. I'd walked along Pat Pong Road. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's kind of red light street down there. And you have to assess, say you're going there, right? You've got to assess, you've got no contacts. This is a red light district. You know there's criminals around and certainly drug people. But you don't want to pick the one who comes up to you because he's probably a nut.
Do you work for a certain gang or is there rival gangs who know you smuggle for a gang that are their opposition?
Well, I had to protect myself and I did by... making myself more valuable alive than dead and functioning. They talk about, oh, people can't get out of the game, they won't let them, or somebody's forced to run a narcotics business. Doesn't happen. Honestly, nobody forces somebody else to do anything, except maybe at the courier level, and that's disreputable people. But I didn't really like it when... the old-style crooks of a certain kind. Not the old-style good ones, like the safe crackers. I had a few friends in that lot. Met them by chance. But the extortionists, the people who'd stand over illegal casinos and take their money off them, sometimes they'd come up and give me a courier. Now, they'd have no intention of... They'd say, oh, David, when she's finished her job, you give me the money, we'll pay her. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure you will, Brian.
Were you still in touch with your old mates and family when you were a drug smuggler? Or did you just go off into the abyss? Was your mom onto you the odd time?
Oh, yeah.
How's the smuggling going?
Yeah, I had a good day smuggling, son, that sort of thing. Oh, very tiring, sweet. Mammy dear,
And did she never go, what the fuck are you doing?
Kind of just be careful.
She'd rather have you as a drug smuggler making $5 million than working in a bar in London. Because she had dreams of grandeur and she was a elitist, posh English woman. And it doesn't matter how you get the money, as long as you can make it seem like we have money.
I think...
How was she cool with the fact that you were carrying gear across country?
If I put her in any social stratum, I think she'd be the same. Because she, like mothers do, have a naive view that their firstborn son is doing it all for them.
Okay. Were you giving her money, yeah?
Yeah, but... she was, at that time, I had 7 stepfathers, and at that time, the one that she was with and stayed with for a long time was wealthy anyway.
What do you mean 7?
Well, different guys would become dad for a while.
Seven, though, is a large
that
number.
That sounds like a lot, but only take it over 10 years or whatever it was.
You said earlier that your wife died due to your carelessness. Why?
Right. I'd retired from the game. Sensible. But because the police were following me, and I'd followed the police who were following me, and it turned out they were quite well-funded. My lawyer told me get out of town because if they've been spending that much money and that much time, they will not.
Does your lawyer know this whole time that you are a drug smuggler?
Oh, yes.
But I mean, so the lawyer knows he's back in
the... I didn't say, Ralph, I'm smuggling drugs again.
Yeah. But the lawyer knows that you're guilty of what you're accused of.
Well, with one's lawyers, you don't have the kind of conversation where you're making a direct confession to something.
So would he say to you, listen, are you smuggling drugs? And you go, no.
Not exactly. He called me in to warn me that one of his contacts had warned him that, you know, they're watching David. So he was telling me to be extra cautious.
So the police are following you, and where does the carelessness come in?
Well, I'd retired, as I say, they were still around. My business
retired.
Yeah. I like saying that at 23. I put in my work.
So you're 23 here, are you?
The period I'm talking about is coming on to 24.
Yeah.
Here's the situation that came along. My old business partner bought himself a Thai businessman who was delivering door to door, selling high-grade Chiang Mai heroin at a quarter of its retail price. Why would anybody sell you this guy? What, he didn't like money? Of course, it was a poison chalice he'd bought. The reason the guy sold him was because he'd already been stopped and this guy was poisoned. But he said, oh, you can get Macmillan Sullivan. I'll introduce you. One night, Michael said to me, the tie's here. Yeah. He's in a hotel. They know it. The police are all over him like a rash. Well, is he carrying? Yep. And it's in his hotel room. What do? The only choice you've got is really to somehow pick it up, get rid of the Thai guy and sneak him back out of the country. So I went home, stewed over that. It seemed very difficult. And this arrogance again, this sort of young person's, That was the addiction, really, to if somebody came to me and said, as they had before, well, you don't know anybody over years earlier. You don't know who to get, where to get it, how to do it. Can't be done. So, you know, it hurt. And it was the same with this night, how to pick up the Thai businessman, make sure the stuff didn't fall into the hands of the police and get away where they couldn't really bring a case against anybody. Managed to do that. It's a bit of a long story, but it did a swap at a hospital where their radio signals were cut off and had a couple of cars planted around. They weren't happy, the cops, about that. And I didn't follow up on it. Here's another rule for your listeners if they're ever thinking of getting up to some mischief, which we advise them against. But if you start something, stay around to clean up. I shouldn't have just backed away from that. I should have made sure who and what and everything about this Thai businessman, because this wasn't the end of the road. Sure enough, he came back to collect some money. He wasn't supposed to, but he did, and they arrested him. He had nothing on him, so what were they going to do? They let him go, he comes back to us, tips the game. We scatter. All they could think of was a mass arrest of everybody. And they did. They arrested me, my wife, Michael's wife, for the whole family. My mother got dragged in, my school friends. Lent on the couriers heavily. They wouldn't talk, of course, because when they'd had trouble, I'd always got them out of trouble.
So your wife was put into a Thai prison?
Yeah. And my wife and Michael's wife held without bail in the prison. Now, I said to Michael, look, we can't have the girls in there. We're going to have to do the unthinkable, do a deal with the cops to get them out. Why? They got no evidence. Look, you want to leave them in there for a year and a half, 2 years while a trial goes on? No. And he just had a young baby. But before that, the police had, you know, in a case where there's nothing more vicious than a case where there's no clear smoking gun or a corpse on the floor. There was no drugs in this case and no proof of anything. It gets nasty. So they put an informer in the women's prison, and with the object of getting information out of the girls that she could repeat in court. Unfortunately, their choice of informer happened to be a psychotic arsonist who set fire to the place to bring them all closer together, I guess, which certainly did. And I woke up to reports of a prison fire. I was in prison, of course, and ran down to see the officers. Women's prison. I heard there were deaths. What do you know? Oh, Dave, information's still coming in. You know what that means. So I had a legal visit and went around the corner and then saw all my family there. I knew what that meant. There were only three killed. The arsonist and the two girls. So this was helpful to the police case because they could scare the couriers into talking, which they managed to do. But
so you think she was murdered?
I had a couple of conversations with some of the survivors years later, and they say no. But then again, really, if the police hadn't put that lunatic in there, it wouldn't have happened. But that's not the same thing as a murder, is it? I don't think they would have wanted that particularly. You know, I'm in touch with some of the officers from those days. They email me and chat about the good old days. Send me surveillance photos of when I was young. Now, I was I'd felt like I'd murdered her.
Because if she never met you,
no, she'd be alive. My, she was pretty much a tearaway. She could have died from something else, I guess. But no,
was she ever directly involved in the smuggling of drugs?
No.
You'd never load her jacket with something and go across?
Oh, no, a bit too close. I think, see, it'd cloud your view, wouldn't it? Imagine you've got people working for you. You've trained them up. Some of them, I mean, they were real, you know, the best of the ones who live in a dream world as it is, gamblers, fantasists, some of the couriers used to go around thinking they were international tennis stars or adopted.
What were parents saying after the death?
They were actually supportive in the beginning. They were felt that the authorities had behaved badly. But when the story was put about by the authorities that I was having all the witnesses killed, starting at home, they put that story out to put the frighteners on the witnesses so they didn't turn on the case.
Have you ever had anyone killed?
No, I always think of it this way. Well, firstly, there's a rule that
you wouldn't say if you have got someone killed.
I never confess to a murder.
Yeah.
I don't know why I call me old fashioned, but it's just something you can't do.
Yeah.
But it would be something I try to avoid because. It's really a failure of the imagination if you can't think of any other way of solving your problem than killing the person. All right, it's a bit different if somebody steams through your window in the middle of the night. Lots of robbers wanted to pay me such a visit and had ambitions on it.
You've had people beat up and intimidated.
No, just convinced them myself to see things from my side.
There's
no need for it. Really, if what you're selling is quality and, like with the Coke, I wouldn't stamp all over it. The people who took it from me got it pretty much as it was because they're getting such a good deal. It's great for me because I can unload, reload, go back, unload, reload, go back. And it was a complex chain where emeralds would be bought with the proceeds of some, then to Antwerp to buy diamonds, then back to Sydney.
Were you doing a lot of drugs yourself?
Gave myself a couple of accidental habits.
Did you ever do heroin?
Yeah, I was in a hotel waiting for...
Inject heroin, like?
I've done it, but that wasn't my favorite. It was too fiddly. And doesn't really work. And it's a really sleepy sort of drug.
They say gear's the best drug you can do.
Is it? I don't know. The first, you know what's good in anything in life and I guess intoxicants is the first 20 minutes of anything is wonderful. You have a drink, the first 10 minutes of that coming on. You have a joint, the first buzz is fine. Everything turns into a fuzzy mess. You know, if that's why I don't like it illegal. I'd like to see drug supermarkets. Fill in the form at the gate and get a card, knock yourself out. All you can carry.
So the Australian prison is the first thing you have behind bars.
Mm.
How does that end?
Well, it ends with a 10 years in prison and also a little icing on the cake for a helicopter escape.
What do you mean?
Well, I was accused of arranging escape by helicopter on the first set of drug charges.
And did you, yeah?
Yes, but I called it off because I realized I was being conned. The guy came over from the Philippines courtesy of Lord Tony Moynihan. For people who have an interest in the history of British swindlers of quality, Lord Tony fled Britain in the 70s, having fleeced everybody here, and set up shop under Marcos's the Philippines.
And he was going to get you a helicopter out of there. Yeah, how do you communicate with people back then?
Well, you know, when they're in prison? People foolishly use mobile phones now.
Yeah.
Which is really... You see how many fat policemen have resulted from cell phones? They don't have to waste their shoe leather getting out and following people around anymore. They tap themselves, dragging these transponders.
So what were you doing back in the day?
Well, we had a code for telephones, the way to have conversations. Like, if I need to give you a telephone number, instead of saying the number, every digit is transposed to, we think of any word or phrase that has 10 letters in it, but they don't repeat, like frozen days. F is 1, S is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 9. And then we put names with that. Michael, I went to that party, you say. Any good? Yeah, Freddie was there. Ralph and Olivia came with him. You know, I'm going through the letters of frozen days.
Yeah.
The number. Oh, and another rule. What you do is you, when you're meetings, you apply a 2 and 3 rule. That is, you talk about it like it's 2 days after when it really is, and 3 hours after from the time it actually is. Not the other way around, because they might hang about. and there's a lot of kind of tradecraft that you pick up as you go.
But as somebody who is so kind of addicted to adventure, were you not bored shitless been behind bars for 10 years in Australia?
No, I found things to do. I was in...
You don't have any sex for those 10 years, do you?
No.
Do you shag other male prisoners?
No. No, your only consolation
is... Do people do that, though?
Pornography. I ran the porno station in one of the prisons, and you get to learn a lot about people.
But it was all just kind of physical fucking images of chicks with big hairy bushes.
Well, except, you know, one of the biggest...
They weren't moving.
No, in the video pornography.
Really? Yeah, back then?
They were more relaxed about it than they are now. They wouldn't even allow it now. But I had one of the biggest gangsters in town come up to me the next day. Dave, can you run that film again at lunchtime? Which one? With the party one? No. The what? The she-male one he wanted. He was... Anyway, why do I care? Even an officer brought in a shit-eating porno film. They use fake shit, you know. Pump up some mixture up.
How didn't... After 10 years, though.
No, I know.
10 years mad. Hanging around with guys, behind bars...
What, I can see definitely, Michael, you couldn't hack that.
Yeah, are you let out for lunch?
There's nothing else that would put you off crime and going to jail.
Yeah, what do you do in jail, though? Is it not the worst thing in the world?
Well, I mean, if I found myself chasing young boys around their prison, I'd, you know, think that I was falling to bits. That would be...
do you have an egg timer in your head constantly, you know, and it's over soon?
Oh, no, no, not me. I quite liked, I was always a bit of a loner anyway. I was a little boy lying under a huge old stereo system playing my parents' records.
What would you do in jail?
Okay, get up to no good as much as possible.
So you wake up in the morning.
Reason. I'd get a job in some key place. I'd usually be, head cook was usually good, but I found that too much work. Then something which would get me closer to being allowed out as soon as possible. Okay, the supermaxes were awful. They were full of people killing each other. One place had, it only held 48, and there were 22 deaths in 1 year alone. I remember Barry had an argument with Alex, and he poured his hobby glue all over him and set fire to him. I went up like a Christmas tree. Died in hospital 2 hours later from the burns. Policeman came in and said, Barry, we know you didn't do those murders.
Did you see many male-on-male rape?
Yeah, and mostly quite comic. There was something went out of control on one of the wings. This was in the Supermax. And a nurse on her trolley, you know, hands out the medicine.
What's Supermax? Because to Irish listeners, that's a popular all-way fast food chain.
Oh, right. Okay. No, this is a prison which has got electronic doors, 2-inch bullet-resistant glass.
By year 8, you not go, fuck this, I'm on the straight and narrow. You haven't smuggled in a decade.
No, but...
you're organising smuggling from prison, yeah?
By the time I ended up in an open prison, I was running the cafe there, which involved making a deal with the head cook. He supplies me with what he wants. I go into town twice a week in the car with an officer. And do my shopping. I also shop for the guys who want to lay their bets on or do anything else, who like Kalamata olives or Gruyere cheese or whatever it is. So I kept my mind going by this kind of stuff and prepare the ground for when I get out, because I knew that, everything was taken away. Utterly and completely, all the property confiscated. Oh, people out there would be saying, oh, good thing to you, rat, drug dealing scum. Indeed. But I only mention it because it cleans the slate. I was sitting in one of these zip-up Supermax high-security suits. They have a padlock on the top so you can't put things underneath it. In a concrete cell with a concrete bed and a steel everything. Nothing except a tape recorder my lawyer had brought in with the recordings from my house, from the bugs there and the telephones. So I can listen to all my previous life, clearly moving about the house, making phone calls. She was upset one day on the phone to her sister. I never found out, of course, what it was. Ghostly echo of what's been taken away. Yeah. I'd improve my craftsmanship for making things out of wood. Smuggling items while in prison. It's always good to... made some very good... You know those Chinese boxes which you don't know how to open and it's got a little... Made a lot of that. Shipped it off when I came to my release date to my friends who had an office. When I get down there, the stuff's gone missing. It turns out by the courier, a day late, all sawn in pieces, a little message from the police saying, you're back, we're back. When everything was wiped away, any prospect of retiring was gone. I felt kind of like, this sounds very strange, but if I just took up some humble life, it would be an even greater betrayal of those lost in the war. And I think it's... The analogy might work because I think they're soldiers who come back from war and never quite settle in.
So you're in jail again then next time, what, 10 months later?
Well, it was when I found that I was being followed everywhere, I decided to draw a line over Australia and move back to the UK. And I was, being followed, it was tricky. I had to go to a lot of trouble to make sure that I had good passports. I got those. Ended up in Thailand just on my way through to pick up some more money. And, I felt free for the very first time. I was floating above the ground there in Bangkok because nobody knew I was there. These were ironclad, these passports. I can't tell you the devious hiding, I went. And I'd even had Michael stay back there, and we'd recorded conversations between ourselves and on the telephone. He'd take my cell phone to a payphone, ring it, play the tape. So the police were convinced I was still there, hiding, but yeah. Absolutely convinced. Nobody, and the sense of freedom was so exhilarating. I mean, since the age of 18, I'd had nothing but things in my rearview mirror. But so maybe I would have left it, but extraordinarily enough, you know, I end up saying this a lot, that if this unusual set of circumstances hadn't arisen, this wouldn't have happened. But you can talk to everybody in prison, and they'll tell you the same thing. They might have been up to some scallywaggery for years, and they'll tell you, I got arrested because the most incredible set of things lined up. That's not always the case. A lot of people get arrested because they're stupid to begin with, especially the jail babies. They're not happy unless they're in prison. I walked into a USDA trap there in Thailand. I saw them at the airport. They were waiting for me there. I got away from the airport. I'd only been 3 days in Bangkok. I got back into town, but they tapped the phone of my friend in Chiang Mai, who stupidly phoned his friends to say that I was coming down to use their phone and make some travel arrangements. Walked into the travel agency. I saw a pile of cigarette butts across the road. I knew that meant something. It meant that somebody was sitting there waiting, smoking away while he waited for his prey to arrive. I mean, I'd taken 3 taxis, 2 tuk-tuks, and walked through a couple of hotel lobbies and a shopping center, so it wasn't from being followed. And I was so depressed at that. I really wanted to end it all. I think if I could have killed myself in the first few weeks in Thailand, I would have, definitely.
So where do they get you?
Well, in this travel agency in Chinatown in Bangkok.
Armed police.
Oh, yeah, they were armed, but one of them only had one gun, and you never grab a policeman's gun. Half the time it's never even loaded.
So what do they do to you? They fuck you in the back of a van to take you to a Thai prison?
No, they took me to show me off to back to their office to show me off to the foreign agencies that had arranged all this, my arrest. And I saw old Bill Shunkman there from the DEA. You know, I said to Bill, oh, I've got you to thank, have I? Look, here's your chance. You've been chasing me for years. You're the villain of the piece. Say your bit. It's really, you know, the villain in a movie is supposed to say something clever at that point of victory. Or he just said to his junior colleague, don't listen to anything this man says. He'll only get in your head. But I wasn't too happy. I wanted to escape. Sure, I mean, that goes without saying. But escape only so I could kill myself properly. You can't kill yourself in a Thai prison. You get no privacy. All around the clock, there's people around you all the time. You're never alone.
Yeah,
well, you can't even take a shit alone. There's a row of toilets.
Is it as bad as they say it is?
It is bad because it's dismal. I had dreams that there'd be some big corrupt foreign section with rich criminals, or, you know, like the Colombians live when they're in prison, or some of them.
Does money benefit you at all when you're in there?
Yeah, but you don't need a lot. If somebody sends you $500 a month, you can be king of a place like that. And a lot of money is no advantage either. You'll just become the thing they want to squeeze to get it out. You have to balance your little bits of bribes and tips and everything very carefully there. This place in, they put everybody, they did a sweep of the airport to find something. They had me on a charge of the 2 passports and the 50,000 that had turned into 4,000. But they wanted some drugs, so they used the airport sweepings for that, which was enough for the death penalty. It was 100 grams or something of heroin. Less it was. But I needed, when I arrived at the court, I saw like thousands of locals all chained up with leg irons on. I asked about that. I found a Singaporean who gave me the lowdown on how it works. His were welded on. I said, How do they get those off? He said, they don't. After I'm executed, they cut my ankles off with a machete. Ah, just asking. Apparently, they're quite valuable, the scrap metal on those things. And death at that stage was by machine gun, which I didn't really object to. None of that. It just was going to take too long.
So you're in a Thai prison. You're awaiting what you think is a death penalty.
Mm.
There's people dying around you every day. You're shitting in a
two
hole
a day,
around
yeah.
people. You're sleeping in piss.
Oh, no. I got organized after a while.
But you're awaiting a death penalty.
Yes. But I wasn't on death row yet. My case was still dragging on. So I realized I had to get out of this kind of narcotics remand prison. They call it Bambat, or it sort of translates as the cure, because it's meant to be for drug addicts and rehabilitation and all of that. But all the drug cases were there. So I got out of that into the bigger part of the prison. It holds about 12,000 in a dozen sub-prisons, and there's a big moat around it, which is 20 meters across. Very high walls. You know, I guess there'd be 6-7 meters. That doesn't sound like much, but it's very high if that wall's in front of you. No escapes ever from there, so that didn't help. I went, managed to bribe my way over to the news section, which wasn't much. When I say bribe, these are tips. The Thai officers don't look at it that way. They look at it like, well,
it's a respect thing, nearly.
I'll help some of the prisoners here, and I'll help the lucky ones. The lucky ones will make me more lucky, and I'll get money from them as a kind of courtesy, yeah, as you say. So they wouldn't understand if we said bribe or anything like that. They'd be thinking they're actually doing their job, but just doing it in the best way possible, and that's to help the lucky. I mean, I'd seen some people try to get out. Incredibly, they'd gotten out of the big dormitory. They meant for about 60, but it had 142 in there. Now, they were aided by mock privacy. The guys, the Thais are very sexually flexible. They would get their towels and anchor them by little pins to one end of the wooden floor and the other one on at an angle up to the mesh window. And that was for a bit of privacy, and they'd have little scenes going on in there. So people didn't pay much attention to the sounds coming from that, but they were cutting their way out. Four of them, what was it, five? Yeah, four of them actually got out of there, managed to get to the outside wall or close to the outside of one of the walls, and then realized they'd all been lying to each other. No, you know, one didn't have somebody waiting for him. No, the other one didn't have a hidden mobile phone. No, he didn't have a rope, said the third one. They turned themselves into the guards, who were outraged at being woken up and being finding these guys out of their cell. They were put in the punishment soi, which means street, which has a history, but it's really a coat locker, half size, with a little letterbox slit. That's their life in there. They have a paint tin, which is their little bathroom. They get a litre bottle of water every day, which is not enough to do everything with, including drinking some of it, I guess, and a bowl of rice. But so you're not bored, they would be dragged out of those little boxes a couple of times a day and thrashed with heavy sticks, which does a lot of internal bleeding. We weren't allowed to see too much of it, but you could hear it, which was somehow worse. The piteous screams of pain turning to pleading wails, sounds that no human being should ever make. And then the worst part, a silence. And yet you can still hear the thump of a heavy object against a flesh-filled object as things are cracking and grinding.
So what gave you the ball bag to say, I'm going to escape from here?
Oh, well, I wasn't going to allow it to come to that. They let the Singaporean because he was a foreigner live, but he never spoke again. And he didn't look the right colour.
But how did you know when you were doing it?
When you don't know.
So how did you plan it?
I was told after almost 2 years that my case would be brought to an end. I would be found guilty. No surprise, everybody is. And I would be given the death penalty, which, even if it wasn't actually applied, because they wanted to, a few people agreed that it should happen. That's the way it works with death penalties and foreigners. You're host country has to agree to it. Not officially, mind. Oh, no, officially they agree to complain about it. Oh, it's barbaric. Yes, we've made objections to Thailand. Oh, terrible thing, death penalty. But a good example to set, don't you think, for all this little troublemaking drug scoundrel. So I only had 2.5 weeks before this was coming to an end. I'd had lots of plans. I was going to go out at the prison auto shop, welded into a VW. Me and my Swedish friend and a Swiss one, we were going to go out dressed as UN medics with a stretcher between us. I had another plan. Some villains I got over to lift me from the court, from the service elevator that used to take the prisoners up to the courtroom. Now, all bad because it relied on somebody else. Now, my Swedish friend was meant to come with me, but he backed out. He said, look, I'd have nowhere to go. I'd get caught again. I'll get you. Give me that photo. I'll get you a passport. It'll be fine. I'll at least get you out of the country. Didn't want to. Didn't like what he saw. And what he saw was a couple of Israeli guys come from Chiang Mai who'd actually got out up there, were on the loose for 2 weeks at the guest house where they'd been hosted by their drug supplier, who turned them in when he'd milked them of the $12,000 they still had. Having shopped them to the cops steam in, and one of them gets away but is grabbed at the bus stop the next day. That's it. See, they didn't have enough friends. I had friends. That's why people were sending me hacksaw blades very carefully hidden in packages. Why people were sending me gaffer tape and cable ties and all the other things I'd need. Because, there's one group of friends were having David Wakes, where we'll never see him again, another very close group. I remember calling Michael, finally getting onto a phone after over a year and a half. Hadn't spoken to him. He'd heard I'd been arrested. And I started to bumble into a very rapid-fire explanation because I've got a short time on this phone. He stopped me. He said, David, don't explain anything. Just tell me where I've got to be and what I've got to bring. Now, that's the kind of answer you want, don't you? Yeah, he's dead now. Anyway, I didn't... It's before Google Maps, Google Earth. I didn't know really what the place looked like other than visits to the Christian church services, which took us to one place which is very close to the outside wall, but it did have electricity running along the top. I'd need a ladder, and I arranged that. I had the only light switch in the place either. Normally the lights are on all the time, but I bought that. So on the, when was it, 26th of August, 1996, that light switch went off for the last time, and about midnight, and I started. I got the, you know how the hacksaw blades came in? They let you have care packages. The locals would have their soap cut in half and shampoo squeezed out onto a newspaper. They weren't getting anything. But the foreigners got a little bit easy because they don't get visits and they need their foreign damn food. But I'd have a big one. It had everything. And I'd always give the guards there a couple of cartons of cigarettes for being a good guy and not giving me a hard time. Michael had made the hacksaw blades in a scroll. It looked vaguely religious. He'd written the Desiderata, that old nonsense from the monk, in it. And hidden in the dowel rods top and bottom of the blades, all lacquered over and painted. A little bit heavy, I found. Now, I was thinking... How can I need one more guarantee thing to distract this officer as he's pouring through my junk. Pornography. I said, Michael, find the most rank, most extreme pornography you can lay your hands on and buy those magazines and put it on the top of the parcel box. The Thai officer was astonished at the, you know, like schoolgirl, teenage anal or something, whatever the thing was. No, he's putting it carefully under his chair and all of that sort of thing. So my blades came in, okay. But back to midnight, I find that all of my timings are out. I've timed it during the day, you know, walk to here, walk to there, spend this much time getting into this next section. It doesn't mean anything's deadly quiet. I can't even cut through the bars properly. okay, I've rigged the cell so that the furniture would unclip and connect into a little ladder to get up to this small window. And my bed, you don't have beds, they're just mats, but the mat was made of 100 meters of army boot factory webbing, which was like a thick linen which unstrapped. So I had my rope and a couple of other things. But I couldn't get more than 1.5 bars cut. So Sten the Viking had to climb up on that thing and drag it, which he managed to spring it out about 6 inches, enough for me to get naked and oiled up and slither through with my bag.
Why was Sten the Viking with you?
Because he was going to go with me on the night. But he backed out when he saw, oh, didn't tell you what happened to the Israelis.
Yeah.
They turned up. Yeah, they got caught.
So you slither out.
The Israelis were all—they'd broken all their legs, you see.
Yeah. So where do you go when you slither out?
Okay, I slither out and I climb along my bookshelf plank, which was part of the cell furnishings, and that had been specially put in there just because they didn't trust foreigners. They wanted to 3 floors above the ground. That pokes into the night air. I climb out in there, and I should say this: the moment I'm outside of that cell window, with my escape kit over my shoulder and looking around in the free night air. Never seen night before. Not for years. I look in the cell, they're like strangers. And I'm like some griffin or winged beast clinging to the wall of a prison. I'm nothing to do with them anymore. I'm nothing to do with anything. I'm just doing what I'm doing.
Mm.
Anyway, I got out of that reverie. I tried to abseil, screwed that up. Burnt my hand sliding down to the ground, flicked the rope off, piled it up, went to my office. I rented something in one of the factories. Took out what Sten had been working on for 6 months. He pretended an interest in oil painting and made the frame.
What do you mean your office?
Well, you had to have a place to hang around during the day in a tie thing. You could go to the factories where they paid you nothing to work like a dog,
yeah.
Or you could pay somebody else to do it while you found better accommodation. I did so in the artist's factory. It was a lot of kids griming away with these shell pictures.
But were you how would there be no prison officers surveyed on you?
There was one office there. But when I went to the office after midnight, of course, they're all gone. There's no officers anywhere. There's about half a dozen on duty, but they're all sleeping. The trustees, the scum, used to be their personal slaves and make up a bed for them at night, you know, with some water and a cooling thing and all of that. So they'd be snoring away, except when they got up for a piss or something, which one did later on.
Was there no, like, sniper looking around the place?
Oh, the outside guard towers?
Yeah.
Yes, but I'm miles away from, about a mile away from the outside wall anyway. I've got to go through, I find, 5 sub-prisons to get to the outside wall.
So what do you do when you're at the office?
Okay, I take out Sten's picture frames, which have been constructed solely to make a ladder. I bag those up and then go into the Chinese funeral offertory factory. They used to make little boxes for Chinese funerals like gifts. But they had bamboo poles, long ones, probably 3.5 meters long, each of them, 4 inches thick one end, thumb thickness the other. Damn thing had been sealed up since the day before, so I had to inch off the nails. And I only mention that because everything's making a noise, Michael. The pincer pliers I'd nicked as the nail comes out. And I know there's a few screws around somewhere. So I get in there, I throw down the frames, put a pencil torch in my mouth so I can see what I'm doing, get out the gaffer tape, make one ladder, then make another. Except I'm stuck inside. I have to break out of that factory, into the auto shop, down, drag those ladders around, and another stick to pull down a coil of barbed wire and get over the first wall. I'm never going to make it at this pace. I'm exhausted now. Probably telling it, but actually doing it on the night even more so. I finally found a system to do it. I joined the both ladders together, tipped them against one internal wall. These are the internal sub-prisons. And then walked up to the top of it, let my weight pull it up the other side like a seesaw, and then drag it down over the top. I went through building after building then and only got my bearings by looking or smelling the AIDS ward. They're the only people who wouldn't rat me out. If any other Thai prisoner saw me, not that he'd have any reason to be at his window, He would have screened the place down. And other people had trusted them. But these poor guys in the AIDS ward were all dying. It was before any treatment, cure, nothing. And I could smell that rotting necrotic flesh dying away there. And I looked up, and there were these sort of ghostly white eyes looking at me beyond hope,
all
beyond
the AIDS despair. Boys.
Yeah. I don't know whether they looked good luck or kill me now. Don't know. But I had to move on. I finally ran into another barbed wire fence and had to go underneath it, getting covered in mud. I had to pause at some place where I thought there was a guard. Finally get to the outside wall, but I can't. My ladder's too long. I can't lift it up. Not only that, there's Mars Bar Creek. It's the inside sewer that runs for 6 feet across on the inside of the wall. It's full of tangled barbed wire. If I try and drag myself over there, if I put my ladder over it, I can't draw it up because there's only a foot and a half of ground by the outside wall. All right. So there has to be a way. And here's where I would have been doomed again if I'd been with anybody. If I'd been with Sten, the Viking, we would have been arguing for precious minutes about how to get this damn ladder over there and all of that. Instead, there's nothing like the prospect of death that focuses the mind. I thought of a way. I put the ladder on an angle, went over the other side to the narrow walkway, broke a bit of the bamboo off, anchored it in the ground, used my rope to tie that end to the far end of that, was able to lift it up a bit, at least swing it over to the other side, get underneath the ladder and arch it up. Of course, there's a little bit of activity from the towers over there, but it's so unthinkable that anybody would be out except fellow guards. Then a bit of noise doesn't mean anything to them. They're not really guarding anything.
Yeah.
There are no escapes. It doesn't happen. I mean, the very few that have been around have never been at night. So inched my way to the... I cleaned myself up first. In my bag, I had some clean clothes and long-legged trousers. Prisoners were not allowed to wear those, and they were khaki, so I had a sort of a plan here. Got to the wire, and it wasn't practical to put a little rubber mat over it for the electricity, so I just incredibly carefully climbed around the electric wires. It was only 240 volts, I know. My friend Martin had built me a little volt meter to check it. Not that I needed that. I could feel the tingling of it coming through the sweat of my trousers as I went. But it was just a tingle. Don't worry about that, David. Don't react to that. That's where the other two guys fell off into the monastery that time 8 years ago. And that didn't end well. The last bit of rope, I'm down to the ground on the other side. I've cleaned myself up with the last of my drinking water and I look halfway respectable. I can't go across. The original plan was to swim the big moat. Everything in a plastic bag tied up. Swim, dry myself. But I know it's all guards' houses in there. I can't go that way. The only way is front. The one place you can walk across this thing. And that's at the main entrance at the front. It's full of shops and stuff and a hive of activity. You can imagine all the fringe businesses that survive off a prison that big. I went around, but this is what saved me from there. My nominal job was working in the umbrella factory. And if it was never there, I paid somebody to be me. But I'd taken one of the pop-up black umbrellas, and it was spitting a bit. I praised the heavens. I put up my umbrella and walked very slowly towards the front, ambling in because it was almost 6 o'clock. I'd seen the allure of a sunrise as I got to the top of that ladder. That was a sweet view too. But going towards the front, I'm a bit like Ripley in Alien, thinking, lucky, 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 lucky. Even inched up to look at one of the guards in the towers, who was kind of looking down, and his body language was a bit... But he saw my khaki pants and figured, oh, yes, it's one of my fellow guards sneaking into work around the back way because he's late. Well, I didn't know that then, but I worked it out later, but... I got to the front and even saw my own personal officer, you know, the one I used to give my ATM cards to go and get cash for me for 10%. He was arriving. And there must be something about the way we walk, because I'm sure he kind of, something familiar about the way I was ambling along. But I kept my umbrella down, got to the main road, which is the 8-lane highway going to the airport, but I'm not going there first. I need a passport. I don't want to end up like the Israelis down in some dungeon with metal bars smashing my legs to mess. I had befriended a Chinese guy in there who was connected with the mischief-making Chinese triads and everybody else, all very good people. And when I say that, reliable. And I had a key tag in my pocket. It was made of wood. I broke it open. I didn't want a key in my pocket in case I got caught. Then they'd torture me to know what it was and who knows what I might have said. I often thought to myself at that stage, what would really happen if you got tortured? Would you talk and what would you say? Never ask yourself a question that fate will provide an answer, but that's for another time. I went to this apartment, as described. Used the key to open the door, went to the little toilet cubicle, started groping around behind the mirror, all the time asking myself, what are the odds, David, that somebody you've met in prison has taken that old radio operator's certificate photograph that you supplied him with and created a passport photo from it, had a passport which must be stolen no less or more than 3 weeks earlier, had the photograph put in there in the requisite stamps, and had it put through on the airport computer, and for this thing to actually be there. But I did strike an envelope and hastily open it up, and there I was looking at myself, because I've got to get out of town. Now, I've left all my money with my friends back in the cell because they'll need it to buy their way out of trouble.
Allies to what you've done.
Oh, they get the blame. And besides, we had one person in there.
Yeah, did the whole place kick off after you left?
When I was discovered missing.
Yeah.
Nobody noticed. Because I was Taipan, as it were. When my cell door was open, nobody looks in.
Yeah.
It wasn't until somebody told them. Even the ladder against the wall, nobody paid any attention to.
Why?
Well, they probably thought it was the works department, and it looked a bit like a Thai homemade sort of...
What do you mean by ladder. Taipan?
Chinese word for big shot.
Okay, yeah.
Because I owned my own cell and controlled who came in there. Normally 14 in a cell like
that. Yeah, but you were paying.
But I only had five. I had my manservant, Jet, and his staff. Well, they weren't in the cell, but there was an American from Honolulu, a Swede, and an Indian people smuggler who got 19 years for nothing. But I knew he'd rat me out straight away, but he was too even scared to do that. But when they came to him, he said, yeah, he's gone. So they were upset. We treated him so well. We gave him everything he paid for. Anyway, off to the airport they're going. But I'm there earlier. Just got to get out. Another friend has left some luggage for me at a long-term luggage depot there. I've collected that. I go over to the ATMs. I've given my cash away, but I've still got two cards to do some traveling. But I have to get cash out. I can't. The cards don't match the passport name, so that's no good. Stick one in and thinking, looking at the board and ticket prices. Get the. Wait a minute. What? Refer to bank. Card's not paying. Second one. Ding. Pays out $500. But where can I go for $500? Singapore. That'll do. Okay. Death penalty there too, and they'd send me back in the blinking of an eye if they knew who I was, but that's where I'm going. I bought myself a ticket, sweated my way through immigration, click, click, click on the computer. These Chinese guys, have they really put it on the computer? Of course not. Stamp. There you are. They had. And I'm sitting in the seat thinking now, okay, they've come to the airport. What have they asked? They've described me. They've gone to the counters. Is that what they're doing? Really? Captain, there'll be small delay. One passenger. Yes, one passenger. What? What do you mean one passenger? Are you waiting for one? I don't know. Glass of water, please. Finally, and much to my relief, the satisfying thwump and decompression of ears as the plane door is closed. Doors to manual and cross-check. Buckle up. Take off. Land in Singapore. I've had an hour. in that seat to look at this passport. It's shit. It's got bad stitching. It doesn't conform to this. The photo looks it came out of, like, you know, it was done with one of those cheap cameras you get in a shoebox. Everything about it wrong. But that's what I got. So that's what I got. I get there, and the immigration at Singapore, he's got much the same opinion as me about this thing. He doesn't think it's that great either. So he's sliding his hand over towards the ultraviolet light, which will reveal, if it was a real one, the blue-green crown and three pink stamps overlaying the photograph. I think I became Confucian and Chinese at that moment because I was praying to them all for a long life and good fortune that somebody had taken the trouble to put that special ink in. And it lit up. We smiled at each other to the immigration officer. Good, you don't have to do any arresting today, and good, I can fuck off out of here. Took two taxis, got a three-star hotel, never a five full of spies, never a one full of criminals, and checked in. Went straight to the gift shop, bought myself some swimming trunks, dumped my stuff in my room, went to the top floor where the swimming pool was, and dived in to the first swim of freedom in 2.5 years. Dragged myself out the other side of the swimming pool and looked over the Changi Hills, thinking, deep end? Why not?
Oh, my God. But you're never, like, you talk about diving into freedom in the pool, looking out over the cliffs. You never really do, though, have freedom.
No, I guess not.
The Thai authorities are after you.
No, they should put in a request with Interpol.
So what did you do, though?
Oh, okay. I needed to get out of Singapore for a start because I knew... Okay, imagine this, if I can ask you. You're working for the forces of darkness, by which I mean the authorities... And, you know, I've probably left the country that day. How do you find me? You know that I'm not under my own name. And if it's a fake passport, it's a stolen one or a lost one. Okay, what you do is, okay, you know that it's going to be a Western one. So you go to the US, UK, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, et cetera, et cetera. Get a list of all their last 3 months of stated lost or stolen passports. Compare that with the names used on traveling passengers the day after I got out. If you strike a hit and McClintock, just remember the name. That was the name of the passport I used that day. If there was a McClintock there, using a passport that clearly was reported stolen in Malaysia 3 weeks ago, and then something's not right. That's probably our man. Or I tell you what, if you actually do that, which I did as an experiment once, found dozens of people travelling under phony names. Sometimes you can be standing in an airport queue and look at somebody and go, yeah, it's not our day. Well, it is our day. Anyway, so... I figured they'd know what that travelling name was, so I had to get out of Singapore. In those good old days of handwritten tickets, I could jumble the names of the passport so that was Mr. George or something, the first name, and flew to where I had friends. And I'd had friends from my Afghanistan hash smuggling days across the border with Balochistan. That's like...
Between my friends, how close would you be to these guys?
Kill for each other. Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
Would you talk? Would you open up to each other?
Yeah. Well, as much as, you know, within reason.
But it's all motivated by money.
It's more valuable than money. People who are only interested in money make all their judgments based on money. And they won't help if somebody looks like it's costing too much to help. Or it's said that person is not valuable enough. But if you've got a track record of helping others, human nature being what it is, I remember my Thai partner, his wife, saying to him, it was reported back to me, but you have to help him because, you know, I put his kids through school and all of that. So what? That was only money. But it's not the point. I would be there if somebody rang at 3 o'clock in the morning saying I'm in trouble. In fact, I like that kind of stuff.
Was it ever isolating because you were the only person who was involved in the circles who came from your background? Like yours was a...
Well, you mean nobody to talk to about posh stuff.
Everyone would have come from an environment in which it was nearly forced upon them.
Yeah, you could say the jail, there was the jail babies and the ones who had come from, you know, an inherited class of crooks, you know, which we have here. There's 100,000 families in Britain. That's what they do. But it's no, I mean, there might be some things that they'd not have an interest in, but there's always something. Every human being alive has the sensibility to perhaps not express things in the same way, but they have an awareness of lots of things. So, but I did like the, you know, science connected stuff. And
so when you're with like your Afghani mates.
Well, I couldn't discuss 17th century French literature with them. But on the other hand, they could tell me all about the Taliban and the Russians. And
yeah, were they anti-American, these guys?
Okay, here's the thing. Let's get back to Pakistan. It was, as Britain closed the door on the great Indian Empire, it did the usual thing, wrecked the place. Divided it up into, went ahead with Jinnah's stupid idea of a Islamic Muslim homeland, caused mass migrations and deaths.
Yeah.
Oh, and just a bit of icing on the cake, take that halfwit up north with Kashmir and tell him to take a biscuit from each cake. And that's been fighting on forever. So job done. We came back home to Britain to, well, you're Irish, so you don't have to wear this one. Another nice mess that'll never grow up to threaten us, because a united India would have been a powerful thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You can imagine. So there, the people who live in Balochistan, say, speak Baluchi. They speak Sindhi too, other people. Each of these zones have their own freedom movement, their own rebels. In fact, because I got arrested there eventually after a couple of years, I came to know that even in prison, they have their political subgroups within there and their leaders, most of whom are in prison. So the Baluchis would, one I'd befriended, Mir Noorjan Magsi, head of the Magsi clan, which was a Baluchi. He was a smuggler, I guess, along the Makran coast.
Yeah.
and he could be quite cruel. And a bit ruthless, but I expected that, but not with me. You find if you go into this kind of underworld, you have to, and to survive well, you've got to make it so you're the exception to normal operating procedure. When I was in Lebanon, you know, I once heard an expression when I was a kid watching silly 50s movies. Yes, but Bawana is the only white man the natives trust.
Yeah.
I thought, yeah, that's what I've got to be. Okay, I might be the white man, the Gora, as they say over there.
Is it humor? Is it charisma? Like, what makes them not view you as killable?
I'll come up with an idea that'll make the money. That's number one. If they have no money, I'll give them a bit. Not spoil them,
yeah.
But, you know. I'll let them rob me of a certain amount, an honest 10%.
Yeah.
You know, you can't send money to that part of the world. It's a gift from heaven.
Did 9/11 surprise you?
I found it was an astonishing bit of theatre.
From an ideological point of view, did you think something was brewing?
They were very tribal, the people there. Afghanistan's been unwinnable from a point of view of dominance. I mean, look at the Russians. Nobody could have tried harder. They didn't succeed. Of course, it didn't help the Americans were giving them Stinger missiles. I could have bought a few at the time. They are so tribal, there's nothing to kind of... You know the way it worked in India? We made them feel like their sons and daughters should grow up to be noble Englishmen.
Yeah.
And so they aspired to be what we pretended to be.
Yeah.
And that worked. But that's not going to work in Afghanistan. No, they don't care. Oh, they don't have any idea. All this religion thing, no, there's nothing to do with anything. That's just, we're talking about from the Afridi tribe or the Magsi clan. That's what counts. Now, if somebody comes along and says, we're all wearing black in this gang. Yeah, what are we doing? Taxing everybody. What else do we do? Yeah, yeah, all right.
So it was mob-orientated stuff, essentially.
Yeah, they're gangsters, and I saw them in Baghdad in the same way. And that helped me. You know, when I ended up in trouble in Pakistan, it was a bit of a light bulb moment when I was flailing around, you know, trying to understand how to get through this thing. I mean, after all, if somebody's in a prison in Karachi, you don't go to court. Your case doesn't go anywhere. You just stay in the prison. You've got to bribe the little clerk who deals with the officer who deals with the courts to get you on the van. You've got to bribe the van drivers to take you to court. When you get to court, you've got to bribe for enough freedom to send the guy into the registrar to get you before the judge. So you've got all these levels. None of this is very expensive, mind you. We used to be given servants. If you were B class or A class, you were allowed 2 servants in the Pakistan or Indian prisons. It applies too if you're a classed prisoner like that. And what is a classed prisoner? By law, a bit of raja or trickery in case just some Englishman happened somehow, God knows how, ended up in a jail, that if you're accustomed to a higher standard of living, you're entitled to your own room, a bed, and 2 servants of your choosing. Now, the servants wanted that job, and they had a reason, because it got them out of prison. They used to bribe the guard to get the job. My servant paid 500 to get to be my badashi, and the dobi wala, the laundry guy.
This is when you're in jail in Pakistan.
Mm.
And is that where you got tortured?
Well, before I got there, yes.
What were you doing in jail in Pakistan?
Every time I've got into serious trouble is during a kind of retirement phase.
Yeah, so you leave Thailand, you escape, yeah. You retired after that.
I had a muse house in London, a perfect life.
Yeah.
Classic girlfriend who didn't know anything different.
She didn't know anything about your past?
Nothing whatsoever. She said one night, what name was I? David Russell or something.
You had a fake name with your girlfriend?
Yeah, I had a passport laying around on one of the flats. She said, I don't want to turn that over. It might scare me. Yeah. She knew something wasn't quite right. She said, you could be a money trafficker or a drug launderer. I said, Eloise, I think they do it the other way around. You know, she had no idea.
So what had you in jail in Pakistan?
I went over there and got... two things kind of happened in a similar way. One of the... I became known I was there because Nurjan, my tribal lord friend, was back in jail over the September 30 massacre. 130 people wiped out on a street corner. Anyway, that case had dribbled on for years and he couldn't get it out on bail, but he was up to some kind
of... Was he involved in that?
Yeah.
He was killing people?
Enema. Oh, yeah, he killed lots of people.
And he was your mate?
Yeah. Look, when I first went there... And, you know, I was being brought marmalade, which they all, you know, watched me eat and everything in the tray. And I fixed up the satellite dish so they could poach CNN and whatnot. I had to stop. I said, no, John, I just heard from the sweeper of all people that a couple of guys are now buried out in the desert. What did they do? They said, your name. Or something like it. Look, I appreciate the gesture, you know. Somebody comes into the area, mumbles something about,
Dave McMillan
or Daniel Westlake, and that's it. They're never seen again. I went in Lebanon. I got there. The 3 guys ended up dead, and the sons are in there crying in front of Dad. And Dad's like trying to make sense of what's just happened because it's been like a couple of hills away. And they say, well, wait a minute, what did they do? And they said, your name. And it brought such tears of loyalty and rage to them that somebody they didn't know, who was not family, was saying, for fuck's sake, their dad's name, leaving the stranger's lips. Oh, fuck that, and bang, you know. The shotguns went off. I mean,
did you enjoy that loyalty?
Oh, who could not?
But the fact that people are dying due to...
Well, it depends who they are, very much.
Yeah.
I didn't mention my name. You know.
Go back to...
No.
Why are you in jail in Pakistan?
Okay. Nurjan sent his school teacher cousin, Iftikhar, off on a mission somewhere and he's disappeared. And it seems like he's kidnapped, but nobody's heard from the kidnappers anymore. And there wasn't enough people left, not either dead or on bail or willing to go in to find out what it was. And the family said, "Do you want to go and see Nurjan in prison? We can arrange that, or he can come and see you. We can get him out for a minute." "No, no, no, no." I thought, that will really muddy the waters. I'd last known location. So I went up and crossed into Afghanistan to find him. He had been snatched, but he'd been, well, complicated it was, he'd been unsold. Now, my helpers over the border in Jalalabad, one of them was connected with my old Thai partner. I mean, this 6 degrees of separation in the smuggling world is so thin. You never go beyond three, and you've got everybody. And they were over there, and he was now sort of proto-Taliban. And I, you know, I said, "What's with this Abdul business? You know, Jake." "Oh, no, it's not like that anymore, David." "They're still putting special dresses over the ugly girls so they can marry them off, you know, with the crosshead." "It's like a box visit in a high-security prison. You can't make jokes anymore about that." "Well, not to other people." I said, "Well, you look the part." I said, "Anyway, I've got to find this kid." So I got over by taxi and I spoke to an Afridi. Now, Afridi is a tribal, right? But they're very pale-skinned and they kind of all look the same a bit until you know them. They were called the Jews of Afghanistan, or it's not even called Afghanistan. See, all these things, names don't mean anything. They're only inventions from our side. Up in Waziristan. And yet you'll see so many English things in it. That I ended up, lots of things happened, but I kind of posed as an antiques dealer. And this was just after the Russians had left and it was a complete mess.
Why though? Why were you there?
Well, I'd got this call. I was in London.
Yeah.
And
just an addiction to it, really.
Because I knew Iftikhar well. I knew his family. I said to the ones around, "So I can send you some money." And I sent that and it vaporized, of course. And I made excuses to go. I really did.
Because you just wanted the adventure.
Because I thought to myself, I haven't been right through Afghanistan. And it was making the news a bit, you know, the Mujahideen and all of that. It just seemed, I kind of like, look, amongst us group, the bunch of hippies that started everything back in the early 70s, the protocol was, one, don't put too much of a loading on whatever goods you've got. You know, be fair about it. Two, you should be of the kind of person who can go to a strange land or New York City where there's nothing and nobody, and from the ground up, within 48 hours, you know who's who, they trust you, and you can do business there. And it was a kind of thing, you know, people would say to each other, you know, Los Angeles was one of the hardest places to do it from the ground up. I didn't know anybody. Hollywood and Vine, you would get, you know, some old song or something.
Yeah.
So I went down there. I ended up with cars full of idiots.
So you wanted to, like, prove your skill set to yourself nearly because it has been your job and your role.
I mean, I always thought, I expected of people that I knew that if I got in trouble, they would do anything to get me out. I always said to the couriers, "Here are your options. If it's such a place, I can't buy you out. You want out, you're out. You'll be escaping." Okay, it's got some things to it, new name, all that. So what?
So why'd you get arrested in Pakistan? So you get arrested in Pakistan and you're tortured.
Yeah. A guy that I pensioned off ended up getting tangled up in a drug case that nothing much happened to it. But because he didn't think I was anywhere in the country or never likely to be, he found it more convenient to, I don't know why he bothered, they don't give a shit, more convenient to tell his interrogators that He'd been working for a David Russell in London, and he owed him gambling debts in the Philippines. I'd never been there. That's why he was involved in the drug business and all of that. Scumbag. Boxer from Liverpool, he was. Even gave them a photograph of me. Can you believe it? What's he done? I said to him sometime later, what were you doing running around with photographs of me? Back when, in the old days, when you're doing a few things for me, what, managing some couriers, what, when somebody travels, you don't carry anything, you don't have a diary. From what they say, you heard everything, everybody's number. I didn't think you were going to be there, David, didn't matter. It wasn't your right name. It was name enough. I've got properties in London and that now. Anyway, this is worse. He told the narcotics division down there that this notorious David with Russian mob connections will have all the policemen killed. They even try and fool with him. Well, that got his back up. I mean, this was the head of the narcotics division who, he didn't consider himself corrupt. He came.
Did you have connection with the Russian mob?
No, I mean, I knew a couple of half-wits from the former states.
Yeah, so how do they get you?
He's got... this imbecile has managed to have my photo stuck around a couple of airports under another name, but it's my photo, all right.
Yeah.
Now, there is talk, too... There was a little bit of unfortunate bloodshed in getting Iftikhar back. One group didn't get along with the other group, and they all killed each other. I got Iftikhar back pretending to buy all these Gandharan art from the Hellenic period. I wonder how many rings from Alexander the Great went for sale. It was in the only place with air conditioning in a ruined Kabul. But the story was floating around, and there was something about a white man who could, agora, as they say. The head of the narcotics division had been also told by the American that David, when he left Thailand, is probably somewhere in Pakistan. And this guy later told me, the head of the narcotics division, that he couldn't understand what... He was expecting to hear about tons, and not a few kilos here and there. You know, only enough money to, set up for something bigger or more interesting. I walked through the airport, I was a bit nervous. I had my friends take me out there, one from who was actually in customs and another one from immigration section. Well, they disappeared quick enough when there was trouble. And at Lahore Airport, somebody saw the old poster that had been stuck down there. And another one said, I don't know why that poster was still there. It was. I end up in front of the head of the narcotics section there, whatever it is. And he's heard all the story about the Russian connections. And now that he's spoken to me, he's going to be a dead man. We'll see about that. Now, there's a few things I didn't know, but I would come to learn about. All the things, Pakistani and prisons and jails and stuff. But when I was on my way there, I came across some little guy. How do the police treat you? Well, they torture. What if you give them money? Then a little torture. Thanks. But this guy was too big to bribe. He was already being paid off by the port of Karachi, hashish smugglers, like huge money. And come to think of it, everything. So he didn't need my miserable bit of shit money.
Yeah.
And as I say, he came from a good family, and he'd been in Washington at the DEA training center. He had a cigarette lighter from the DEA. I saw that there. So he took great objection when I said, I'm sorry, but look, I've got really nothing to say to you. I told your colleague, yes, did he say you were going to see the doctor? Yeah, he did. What did he mean? Well, I'm the doctor. Now, they did the traditional beating of the feet. It sounds like, oh, yeah, it's going to hurt, but, lots of things hurt. You might lose your feet over it. Might not be able to walk for a bit.
So they arrest you and then you end up the doctor.
All day, yeah. Nothing. I won't
talk. So what do you mean with beating the feet?
Okay, some half-wit from prison guard has got his rifle slung over his shoulder, chains up your hands, you're dragged over a table, feet sticking out one end, and your interrogator aims, lucky they like cricket, aims up and goes for the inside of the foot. And it hits a series of nerves, and with a tendon in there, it stretches them. And it does, it penetrates right through the top of your skull. So, it's not good. But when he wasn't making progress with that, they switched to electricity, and nothing could even conceivably compare to electricity for hopelessness and terror. It just penetrates every fiber.
Well, they sit you down.
I didn't like it. When I walked into the room, there was a truck battery, a 24-volt one, sitting on a tea trolley and a couple of old teacups around it. It hadn't been used that day, I guess. They let other people see the sticks on the wall, but they usually keep that one hidden. And, you know, they got a laugh out of the alligator clips. They put one on the toe and then put one somewhere else, and then I jolted. We haven't even put the battery on yet. This guy is a crack up.
They're laughing at you as they're doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Why are they doing it? To get something out of you?
Supposedly, but I didn't understand that, firstly, nothing you say to the police in India or Pakistan can ever be used in court. Because they so notoriously torture people for confessions, everybody goes there with a confession, but the confession is never seen. It can't be shown to the court.
How does the torture end? You've had enough pain, they go, right, get out of here.
No, it depends how bored they are, how much they get curious about. I'd said to, in the back of my mind, I thought, this is bad, because you can't breathe. You are ready to talk. I thought, okay, you say your first story was shit and now you're telling the truth. Go for that. But you don't tell them anybody or anything that's really true, but you certainly can't expect them to accept the first story, because that means all their years of experience torturing people have meant nothing, because they always tell a second story or more story or something.
Yeah.
You know what the worst part of it, though? This is how torture really works, and they know this. The agony of it is bad enough. No two ways about that. If there was that button I've got in front of me on your desk would end my life, I'd happily press that instantaneously rather than go on with it. But what destroys your brain is the timing. Go back to the cell, get dragged in for another session. Stop, go away, start again. A bit of juice, then another 3 seconds of it. That was longer than last time. You know, as you know, you can feel it escalating. I got out of it in the end. I had a bit of luck. But if somebody was subject to long-term torture over a period of weeks or months, it would rewire that person's brain. That brain would never be the same. Its survival instincts, its wish to die, its whatever, would scramble that brain. And no matter what that person said to you, they would never be the same.
Why are you not in jail now, though?
In 2016, I was arrested unexpectedly by the police who work in the extradition section. Thailand had finally scored a goal getting somebody back there. Lee Oldhouse was his name. He killed an American Marine. You know, what do you expect? Kill an American, you'll pay for it one way or another. And so who was next on their list? Some little pain in the ass whose escape book was sitting in the airport taunting them every day for years. It's the kind of thing the tourists like to read. So I thought, well, this isn't going to work, until I realized, it's most likely it will work. They're going to pass this one, and they did. They kept on going, and I was losing. I had experts saying that I'd be a dead man if I went back there, and I would. But I found that there was a way out. I had two plans. The plan B was to physically get out of it. Didn't have to do. But the ideal plan was to give everybody what they wanted. Thailand, it seems, didn't actually want me back there, but they wanted the court to say, yes, you can have him. Because they knew if I was back there, they'd have to give all these big guarantees that I'd still be alive. But I lost the jobs of many of the staff
there. Well, you're not deserving of prison time in the UK.
Sorry. For what?
How many drugs you've smuggled, how many things you've...
Michael, you could write a book in which you purportedly confessed to telling of... I don't know about murders, it's a special rule. But every other imaginable crime, that's not evidence against you. There's no evidence against me. And what I say from my memories...
Would police know you and stuff? Do you ever get spotted around?
Oh, yeah, I've had a few police come to stop me locally, had me sign a copy of the book or something.
Yeah?
Except for one guy, Biggs, you know who you are. He was a pain in the ass who wanted to do me some harm and set me up over a parcel. I ended up in court over it. But no, I mean, I haven't done anything for over a dozen years. I was getting paid for advice giving here and there. You know, sometimes people had unique problems.
In the underworld?
Yeah, and they wanted a way out of some difficulty. I'm sensible enough not to go and do it now.
Yeah.
You know, I'd tell them, this is what you've got to do. You know what? They very rarely do it. I get paid, but they very rarely...
It's fascinating, though. It's fascinating the way you see how it kind of is weighed up ethically by people who aren't in crime, but who are in crime, but you kind of realise that...
Well, I don't approve of stealing from somebody because that's not business. There's no arrangement there. It's just depriving somebody of something, and it's tacky. In fact, most crimes. But the thing with smuggling is so artificial. The bloodiest fight I ever saw on a beach over smuggling, you know what was it at issue, what the goods were, what people died for that day in Malaysia? It was garlic. Some imbecile in Malaysia decided to put a 400% duty on garlic from Thailand, instantaneously making a black market. And police, being what police do, enforce rules, doesn't matter how silly they are, they didn't like these garlic smugglers in their fancy cars with their gold chains hanging around. You know? Can you imagine if peanuts were outlawed? You know, a generation down the line, dads would be saying to their kids, "Yeah, look, I was a macadamia person myself these days, son, but look at those walnut guys, the scum, their big houses, their flash women." Why is Google and Facebook and Instagram, why are they all the villains? Because they make money out of it. If they didn't make any money, they worked out of a crappy office somewhere, you know, with some cross-eyed fat halfwit on the front desk. Somehow they're responsible for everything that's on their platforms. It's just the most ridiculous. I bet you people complained about the telephone. They probably rang up the telephone company, BT, and said, "You wouldn't believe the call I just got."
Yeah, so you wouldn't kind of view any organised crime as wrong, really. What about people on the streets, the gangland problem in Ireland, the UK, people getting shot over territories, heroin influences?
Well,
what about the influence the drug has on people's lives?
I think, just from a personal point of view, I think I could have done something different with my life, and I should have. I would have enjoyed it probably more. I really could have. I was too intrigued and arrogant and to put in the hard work of doing 7 years in a university, you know, living modestly. Not that that really ever bothered me, but so I was wrong to make that choice. But as far as really all the ills of drugs are due to their illegality, I really think everything should be legalized completely, including heroin, because we're at a point where soon this will be academic anyway. Can you imagine? I know people talk about the future as though it'll never happen, but when it makes the point, when the implants come along, similar to the cochlear implant, where instead of getting drugs for your epilepsy, your implant gets triggered by a little program. Mm. And so you don't need drugs because your various problems can be solved by this program. Mm. There will be programs that make you feel good.
Yeah, yeah.
And people have theirs taped down, like I had my morphine drip when last time I was in hospital. I had to take it off me. How are they going to ban the idea? And that's what a drug is. It's a thought. Now, as far as if you make a black market, you deserve the people you get in it. Now, we behaved a little differently because we were kind of vain and had fancy notions that we were a better class of people. We weren't. And we're just as ruthless and probably more so because, you know, they didn't see it coming. But
in terms of the death and the rape, like a lot of guys you would have worked with were probably involved in the trafficking, though, of like 13, 14-year-old females around Thailand.
Nobody
like
I ever knew would let them live long.
So they would have been the antithesis, really, of the kind of
drugs smuggling. Gave crime a bad name. No, they'd meet with an accident.
Okay.
And they'd often get invited somewhere.
Yeah.
And never be seen again. Now, there was quite a bit of housekeeping, especially in the past, when you could get away with more. But
do you have grandchildren or kids?
Yeah.
What's your kids make of it?
One of them is very selective on who she talks to about it. The other one was a bit of a fan because she was younger.
With age, you're kind of becoming mythical. You're becoming nearly the stuff of legend as opposed to...
I think also because this kind of life doesn't get lived very much anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of oldie, isn't it, a bit? You know, the things where you could travel around in the same way, those days are almost gone, aren't they?
Yeah.
Say you and I decided, okay, we're going to restore the crown jewels of the former Shah of Iran. And they're held by those foolish guys who make life hard for their own people. So, justifiable robbery in this case. Besides, do something more interesting after we've fondled them for long enough. That is a robbery, yet I would justify that on the grounds it's too interesting to pass up on.
Were you ever involved in burglary?
Oh, no, never burglary. That's somebody's house. But robbing things, like a gun robbery once.
Walk in there with a gun?
No. Robbed in to get guns.
Okay. Have you ever been involved in torturing somebody else?
No, I wouldn't have never allowed that, ever.
Have you seen someone be interrogated? Have you grabbed them by the hair and go, what you fucking use my fat out for?
Not with that accent.
Yeah.
I did. I've feigned it. For example, the Indian guy that was in my cell that night, I thought he was going to screen the place down.
Yeah.
And bring me to an end. And he was making little murmuring noises, but I wanted him to shut up. I leant down and sounded utterly convincing, because I'm sure I genuinely believed it at the time. I said, his name was Mirage. Mirage, the only reason you're not dead now, the only reason I don't kill you, is that it would upset my cellmates. Now, they have things to do, and I don't want to be slowed down by your miserable death. But believe me, one more sound out of you, and that's it. Now, sometimes that's what's called for. And you have to kind of feel like you believe it at the time to make it effective.
You don't even, because your life was so mental, have the time to fear death. You just kind of have to have an attitude constantly that it's not going to happen to me.
It might happen.
When you're climbing over ladders and you're climbing over Mars bars, fucking rivers or whatever the shit, you can't obviously envisage the fact that the bad can happen here.
No, it could, but the greatest fear is being made helpless. After being tortured, I thought, I'm not going to let that happen, no matter what. And everything I planned from then on you know, in, well, it wasn't really, I kind of backed away from places where, I mean, I even went to Russia after that, and there was a bit of a mess there, but I realized that I didn't really have the will to go on to answer any more dangerous questions. I felt like I'd learned enough of all of that.
How often now, like when you're walking around the place, do you think about it? Do you just go to the supermarket and someone, you're putting your bags in your bag and you're walking around other people your age and you've escaped Thai prisons, you've seen crazy. Do you just kind of, does age just kind of normalize everyone nearly regardless of what the past is?
Kind of. It depends what, you know, in some ways, some things, there's two aspects. There's a kind of rather the duller but interesting aspect of looking at things as smuggling devices. What could I pack in that? How would I get away with that? I've used glass and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And you, also in the business, you realize it's not what it's in, but where it looks like it's come from and who's carrying it. It's the who, how they present. That's why you can't threaten somebody. I've said to some idiot, you can't threaten a courier. He's got to bounce in there like he owns the goddamn world, you know? Anyway, your threats mean shit. Everybody knows you're a yellow belly. I mean, look, I've got quite a few books I want to write. I need more time. I've got a day job. I put in CCTV cameras and fix other. I've got little bits of a family to feed, so I've got to keep working. Yeah, there have been times I thought, I should do a couple of quick runs. Yeah.
Would you have it in you physically anymore, though?
To deal with it, I think I've been saved a bit. I probably would have weakened a couple of times because I've come across people that would have bankrolled something, you know, anything I came up with. So, and I think. But, you know, I really can't betray my family any more than I already have, so...
Are you currently married?
Yeah, I've been with Jeanette for 20 years now. Okay. And, you know, and a couple of those years I've been banged up somewhere. I've always been organized in those places, made the best of it that I could. I'd say if you had to get arrested and jailed, Switzerland or Scandinavian countries are your best.
Yeah.
It's awful before you're convicted. It's all in solitary. But, I'd like another lifetime. But there's some things that, look, that, even though people think, well, you, the only ethics you had were self-serving, nonetheless, I don't think it really matters. The point was it allowed me to see and understand some things that I wouldn't have understood otherwise. And... this last book, Unforgiving Destiny, took a long time to write, especially the bits on the torture in Pakistan, because I didn't understand it without for years. But I'd like to do fiction, and cause there are also a lot of stories you get where the people are still alive, or their families are still alive. You can't tell them. I mean, there's a couple I'm itching to tell. I can't wait for them to die a natural death, because the story is so interesting. And you wouldn't learn those things without having been in it. But we all need 10 lifetimes, don't we?
Fascinating to talk to you, and I appreciate you coming on the Michael Anthony Show.
A pleasure to be here, Michael.
Thank you.
It's been how many years, my boy?
Audio books, David. Shorter than
you
audio books.
You still don't know my chairs of joy. No need to go, just take it slow.
Podcast.
And have you heard the Michael Anthony Show?
Makes me feel just fine.
What's it
makes me see the light.
What about those cheers?
Believe my eyes.
How's it make you feel?
Makes